Session number 13265, reel number 12.
Eric Marsden, reel 12.
In severe frost, exposed aero engines have the oil become extremely thick and viscous, so they're quite difficult to turn. And if you start them up and run them up in those conditions, if you can get them to start at all, then you have the danger of the very thick oil generating excess pressures in the oil systems and blowing joints and trouble of that order. So that it's necessary to keep the engines above freezing and at a reasonable temperature as far as possible. We were not as good at it as the Russians were, by any means, I don't think. But this system was quite reasonable. Whilst we were getting through the development period with the aircraft, getting them operational and usable, we'd also gone through a kind of development of work stands. The introduction of these big aeroplanes had meant that the normal long step ladders, which the RAF already had in use, were not really good enough for working on the engines on aircraft like the Halifax of the Stirling, simply because those step ladders, if you're right at the top and you're trying to apply force to a spanner, it's quite easy to push yourself away from the main source of stability, which is the engine, and you feel the stepladder tilting away. In other words, it's not a stable platform at all. And it was therefore decided that it would be necessary to make some new type of stands. We tended to call them engine stands, although they were not to stand engines on. One of the first things that was sent up was a frail tubular steel erection, which was designed by somebody at Group or in Bomber Command or somewhere, of quite relatively small diameter steel tubing, 3/4 inch or inch, on something which was only about 3 feet square or 4 feet square base. Offhand, I would say about 3 feet square. They were tubular sections which simply pegged together, one fitting inside the other, with socket ends. And the crossbars on this were fairly widely spaced, but it was intended that they were to be the ladder by which you climbed up it. The end result of this is that you are standing with your... it's easy to exaggerate here, but at a guess, your feet, when working on the top side of a Merlin engine on a Halifax, if you're standing up, your feet are going to be about somewhere between 6 and 8 feet from the floor, and you know, add to that your own height. Well, if you find the picture of the Halifax, which was issued in connection with the RAF Museum at Hendon appeal for the new Bomber Command Hall, you will see incorporated in the picture one of this very type of stand, which is a grave mistake, because we tried them and promptly threw them away because they were grossly unstable. In fact, they were downright dangerous. It was quite possible to be standing on the top of one of those stands and use some weight into a spanner and so on and have the whole thing go over. And also because of the relatively small base area of the thing, although it although they stood on steel disc feet a few inches across on each leg, the thing was rickety unless the ground was perfectly level. If you were on concrete, as of course it was intended to be, it was reasonable, but even the concrete hard standings were not always plumb, and so the things were rickety and wavy, and anyone who was not sure-footed and happy with heights, of course, was distinctly unhappy up those things. And the moment you tried to handle a cowling, if you tried to handle a large top cowling with one of those and you get the wind catch it, you could be blown over very readily. So they were a waste of time. And I think that the next things, or the successful jobs that we tried, were probably designed in group. And these were platforms on two main wheels, standard truck wheels, and I would guess that these platforms were about 12 feet square on the base, 10 feet square on the base, something of that order. Sufficiently, I've exaggerated, they're not square, for starters, but they're of that order of width. They are sufficiently wide that at each side of the full width of a Merlin engine nacelle, there was enough width for, I think, three walkways, like three tiers of seats or steps in a grandstand on either side. And from the top one, you could comfortably work and reach across a Merlin engine. These were probably used on aircraft with radials later on, but Merlins we had at that time, and this is what I know. These were of substantial steel tubing of the order of 2.5 inches diameter, with a jacking leg at each corner, which could be lowered and set into place with a locking pin, so that they were reasonably stable, and they were so heavy that a little bit of rock across the corners was of no great moment. In any case, you had the footprint of the two tyres as well as the four stabilising feet. They had a steel tube handle which came from the front, starting from one side, raised up horizontally across and down to the other, so that you could get at least four men on, which was necessary because they were heavy. But these could be wheeled into place under the engine and the stabilisers put down, and you could work on these quite solidly and safely. They had a wooden deck. There was room underneath, so that if you were draining glycol or oil from the engine and so on, there was plenty of room underneath to get receptacles underneath to carry the stuff you drained off. Onto the top, we could fit engine covers similar to the ones previously mentioned. And so that it was possible to rig an engine cover on one of these, and you could work under there in foul weather, which previously we'd been unable to do, unless we had the other type of engine cover. Was a little bit narrow and awkward, and to get a tall stepladder inside there, a little bit tricky, so that they were not too satisfactory for this purpose. But these were very good indeed, and made life much easier. For engine changes, it wasn't too long before we saw brought into the hangar on an engine stand, which was a heavy steel trolley, the base rather larger than the Merlin, with a framework at one end onto which was attached a dummy bulkhead, and fitted to that was a complete set of engine bearers and engine and ancillary units normally fitted in front of the nacelle. And the idea of this was that this, after electrical and plumbing connections had been released, You could simply release the engine from this onto the crane, lift off the unserviceable engine, and simply transfer the two bodily, instead of having to take all the bits off first and then lift the bare engine out and replace a bare engine and put all the bits back or onto the engine and so on. This, the idea was that there would be nacelle changes to speed up servicing. Well, it was an excellent idea, but we only ever saw the one, and it didn't get used because there was no system for none, as far as I knew at that time in 1941, no system was developed for shipping the replaced nacelle unit back to any maintenance unit and getting replacements. So it was one of those good ideas that at that stage wasn't off the ground. And where were we? Oh, the daylight operations came up and they did a daylight to Kiel. And one of the aircraft came back and it had been fired upon. I don't know whether it was light ACAC or by aircraft, but a 20 mil round, I think, had gone in through the belly adjacent to the beam position on the starboard side, where a wireless operator or one of the flight engineer or someone could operate the hand-operated beam guns which were used on the Halifax. When the aircraft came out, there was a large window on either side. These were staggered, fitted with a removable Perspex window and frame which could be lifted out, and the Vickers K-gun could be swung into position in the centre and locked on a swivel mount, on a pivot mount. And the gunner standing there received the benefit of the explosion from this round under the floor. He got it right in the crutch, and I think he bled to death on the way back. And the end result of that was that the blood which leaked from him into the inside belly of the kite under the plywood flooring got into the interstices between the stiffening frames and the skin and the lunger and the stringers and the skin and so on. And although the floor was taken up and the thing was scrubbed, you never get that kind of thing clear. The result was that when that aircraft was repaired and put back into service and got a little bit warm, summer was coming up, you find yourself flying in a very nasty smell. So they took that aircraft off operations and I was landed with it. I got it in because at this time I was LAC. I can't remember whether I was LAC or corporal at this stage. But anyway, I was more or less IC ground crew on an aircraft, and I got this kite, and it was flown on conversion flying. And when it got warm, it smelled horrid. And not really very encouraging to the trainee pilots or whatnot, is it? Although these trainee pilots, of course, were already operational pilots. Round about this time, April, May, somewhere about this time in 1941, I was sent on a Rotol course down to Gloucester, did a maker's course. I can't remember whether it was 2 weeks or a month. And I came back as the one chap in the squadron who was now fully informed on the Rotol propellers that we used on the Halifax at this time. Although most of the textbooks will tell you that the Halifax had the Jablo hydrolignum type wooden blades, all the first aircraft out, for a fairish run in the production line, had magnesium blades. Interesting that, because most of the aircraft was magnesium alloy too. And in addition to being fully informed on normal servicing procedures on the propeller, removal and refitting and so on, I was now the only person on the squadron with the data on maintenance of these magnesium blades. Now, normal maintenance on metal-bladed propellers is to blend out notches and scratches on the leading and trailing edges to avoid the formation of cracks which develop from sharp-edged cuts. But what was not yet generally understood in the services, because metal propellers were metal VP propellers and so on of this order were not too well understood, was that surface damage could also be dangerous. And in fact, Rotols issued everyone who went on the course with a handbook which included graphs and diagrams showing the amount of damage which could be sustained and sustained safely. And there was a particular area out towards the propeller tip. If you take a large hand like mine and look at it, that which would be about the size of the tip of a Rotol propeller, then within the region of the lower palm, towards between the ball of the thumb and the heel of the hand, in that area, well down, there's a small area there where the maximum amount of damage allowable is of the order of about 10 or 11 thousandths of an inch deep, which is not very much. An average scratch from heavy gravel and so on could get close to that. And so it was necessary to inspect the propellers quite carefully. And as a result of going on the course, myself and an LAC who became propeller kings, the term king is used in the RAF for someone who was in charge of one particular thing of this order. And it was our job just to go around and do all propeller changes and keep an eye on all the props on the squadron. We did the inspections of that order. And so I had to obtain for myself a depth gauge which I could use to inspect damage of this type on surface damage as well as the leading edge and trailing edge damage. Had to get made up a chemical solution with which to treat the bare metal after we'd scraped and polished it and fared it into a clean condition. If I remember correctly, I think it's a potassium chromate solution of some kind, and that restores the chromate finish on the magnesium, which is an anti-corrosive finish before painting it. Anyway, one day I found a propeller with a cut which was well above the allowable tolerance in this area of the blade. So I went in to see the flight sergeant to the flight concern. I said, I'm very sorry. I said, Kites US need a new propeller. We need a new propeller? There's nothing wrong with it. Because he'd seen the thing standing there and it looked like a propeller, you see. You know, no obvious damage. I said, well, I'm sorry. I said, but according to the book, that one's US. I want to change it. Nonsense. And so on. And we have, you know, I'm an LAC and think I still may have been. I think I probably still was a LAC at this time. Might have been corporal. Anyway, I'm arguing with the flight sergeant, which is not a good arrangement. You know, not if you want to be happy. I said, I'm sorry, I said, but I'm going to write it US in the book. I said, and after that, you do what you like. I said, because I'm in the clear then. I said, I've written the aircraft US. I said, if you want to write it serviceable, it's on your back. Well, we got the engineer officer. So he fetched the engineer officer down, who was a good bloke. And he didn't jump in with both feet. He asked me why, which is a sensible question in the first place. To the bloke hadn't. So I showed him the damage, and I said, and here's the chart. Why, says he. I says, because that point is a particular nodal area where when the blade is flexing and vibrating in flight, that particular point is particularly vulnerable. It's a node about which the vibration occurs. I said, and it is therefore limited as to the amount of damage it can carry and still be viable and not fail. I said, if you leave that, that tip is going to come off and going to go hurtling through the cockpit or somewhere else and cause somebody a new nasty. Ah, right. US, change prop. So Chief is as disgruntled as blazes because he's one less on the serviceability board for operations, you see. And we change the prop, put a new one on, and that one goes away. End of subject. About a week later, 58 Squadron Whitley came back with a dirty great hole through the fuselage where it had shed a chunk of propeller blade for exactly the same reason. And I was thus able to say, I told you so, with a small amount of glee, you see. And, well, you know. And after that, of course, one's position with regard to the propellers is reinforced appreciably. Yeah. Round about the same time, a 58 Squadron kite was running up between the hangars, and there was a sudden bang. I was at the end, the other end of the hangar, adjacent. And I don't know what we were doing with the Halifax, but there was a heck of a clatter and a rattle, and the spinner had flown off, and one or two of us, we heard the bang and looked around to see what was happening. You tended, at least those of you who were alive and alert in the services, you tended to be very aware of the sky in those days, and I always was. And so I saw this object come hurtling through the air. The spinner had come off. It had been improperly fitted. They ran the engine up and the spinner came off. And I suppose it went something like 150 feet in the air and then came thumping down on our side, just miswrecking our aircraft. Because if it had come onto our kite, it would have damaged that, made it US. Which goes to show somewhat some of the forces involved in these things. Well, I had a little bit of trouble about this time. At Linton Ouse, up to this time, you were allowed to keep a camera on station. That is, just to possess it on station, because the station standing orders had not been amended since the beginning of the war. And so I booked my camera in so that I could come on station and off station with it, and when I had any film, I could take the odd picture in York or wherever. But, of course, being the kind of bod I am, I'd also snuck it out onto the airfield and taken the odd picture of Halifax as being serviced. When I'd been on 145, I'd had a Zeiss baby box camera and I'd taken pictures of hurricanes there, including the one of Boyd's with the special canopy on, which are, as far as I know, the only pictures extant of that particular aircraft. And so when we got to Linton Ouse, one of the things I did was to make a little safe light printing box. I got a cardboard box which had been the carrier for a gallon gallon? Yes, I think a gallon can of hydraulic fluid. It was a stout box. I cut one end out of it and cut windows in the other end, the one with the still had its solid end in. I cut windows out of three sides and pasted the khaki toilet paper that we had in those days over it, and which seemed to make quite adequate safe lights for the old slow film. A deep orangey light came out. I cut a hole in the top and fitted a light socket into it and put a bulb in there. Cut a slot in one side at the bottom so that the printing frame slid in and out, and went into the laundry room in the barrack block, and switch the light out and so on, plug into the other light for this, and lo and behold, we have a little dark room. A couple of trays, mix up some fixer and developer, and contact prints in and out, and there I am, knocking out 3.5 by 2.5 contact prints of Hurricanes and Halifaxes, which Bodds are quite delighted to buy at about 6 months each. Well, you get a few sixpences together and you can buy a film and some more developer and keep the thing going, you see. I wasn't at all worried in terms of security about the Hurricane, because the Germans had captured enough, and I wasn't worried about the Halifax, because by this time one of those big section detailed drawings of the Halifax had been published in, I think, Aeroplane. You've probably seen the kind of things, haven't you?
Yes.
So, and I thought, well, if that's been published in Aeroplane, there'll have been 24 copies arrived in Berlin almost immediately through Switzerland or Portugal or wherever. So if I take a photograph of a Halifax on a 3 by 2.5, 3.5, 2.5 out on the airfield, it's giving no information away whatever, because we're the only Halifax squadron. Well, there was a second one forming, 76 were forming by this time out of us, or thereabouts. So I was quite certain in my own mind that Jerry knew that TL and MP were Halifax squadrons, and there was nothing to learn therefore about the codes. So I thought, well, I can't get into very much trouble if anybody picks me up on this. And the blokes, of course, all wanted to have pictures of Halifaxes to take home and say, these are, look, this is what I work on, you know, big four-engine bombers, big stuff, you know. We were some stuff in those days. You know, there were only three or four four-engine squadrons in the service. And like a Charlie, I took some of these negs down into York to get some prints done myself, instead of doing the printing myself. And the chemist, of course, reported me to the police, who reported me to Special Branch, and I was up on a fizzer. Well, the result of that was that the SPs came, found me, told me I was on a charge, and searched my kit. And in my kit they found a Lee Enfield 5-round clip with 5 rounds in it. When we'd been on 145 at one time, we'd been issued with